Welcome back to the Hawkins Reports, a Stranger Things podcast by LSG Media. I'm your host, Dean.
I'm Jessica.
And on this week's episode, we're talking Chapter 5, The Flea and the Acrobat. Jessica, how are you doing today?
Oh, you know, doing pretty good.
Nice. What do you think about Matthew jumping on this, Jessica?
It's all right.
It's all right.
Unimpressed.
Whatever.
Whatever. She was her nails while she answered that.
I'm excited too because, you know, it dawned on me before we started that I was like, you know, this might be for a lot of people listening their very first LSG Media podcast. And maybe they've never heard me before. This is their first introduction. So I have a clean slate. They haven't heard all the other awful things I've said on all
the other shows. That's right.
Valid point.
A good reputation.
They're like, who is this sweet boy with a southern sensibilities who lives on the West Coast now? Oh my God, did he just make a dick joke?
Sounds about right.
It's possible. Well, I should probably just give the disclaimer now that we are not going to be spoiling anything other than the episode that we are in. We have not seen the future episodes, which is nice. That's something that we've changed from the first four. And we will be spoiling this episode. We will be swearing. And so you've been warned. So there you have it. I think that we should probably tell people how we do this. What we typically do is we open with some initial impressions. We get to the episode. Then we have some listener comments. And then we wrap things up with some final thoughts and possible predictions or observations that came up along the way that we missed. And then we say goodbye to all of you. But before we even kick that off, I think I need to remind people that this is being recorded live on Mixlr. That's mixlr.com/lsg-media. mixlr.com/lsg-media. You should check it out. We do all of our shows live for the most part. And we have a lot of fun. We get input on the fly. People correct us. People hang out. They do their thing. They're part of the show. It's like interactive and stuff, bro. So you should totally do it. But that's all.
You can write us when we're wrong, which we often are.
No.
Exactly.
No. We are wildly apocryphal at times, but that's what makes the show a lot of fun. So thanks to everyone who decided to jump in on a lazy Sunday morning to say hello. Well, afternoon for us, morning if you're on the West Coast. And I don't even know if you're in England. I think you're like 5 or 6 o'clock at night over there, which is cool. I'm hoping to see some of our British friends.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're interrupting tea time or some kind of thing like that, but we'll just carry on.
You can sip tea and listen to a podcast.
Yeah. So Matthew, I am going to start with you. We're going to put the brunt of this on you since you are guest appearing on this particular podcast.
Right.
Although you are a science, you are the cornerstone of our podcasts with as much hosting as you do. You, like you said, people are going to be new to you today, possibly. So why don't you give us a quick, well, take as much time as you need. I'm not on a time limit.
No pressure,
no
Matthew.
Pressure.
Jesus.
Give me a season overview thus far and some of your thoughts on The Flea and the Acrobat.
Well, okay, I guess since this is my first time ever getting to talk about this show at all, I got to say, I was never reluctant to watch this show, but I was slow coming to it. I kept hearing, it was one of the things where I wasn't like, ooh, Stranger Things, this new show, I'm going to hop right on it. It took me a while. It's one of the things where I noticed the internet just being flooded with it and everyone's talking about it. And then you guys started watching it, and I was like, okay, I guess I got to check out this show. And I was fucking hooked 10 minutes in, totally into it. This show is fantastic. And one of the things, I actually even just made a Facebook post about it. You know, there's a lot of talk about this show's influences. How you can see the Goonies and E.T. and lots of old, you know, late 70s, 80s sci-fi and some horror tropes here and lots of homages. One of the things I haven't hardly heard mentioned at all that this show is fucking dripping with to me is the Phantasm movies. The soundtrack, especially the brotherly affection, you know, the brotherly story about Will and Jonathan, and there's just the setting, the town, and the idea of a evil force kind of slowly branching out and corrupting the entire town. So Phantasm. And I would love, if I could ask the Duffer Brothers anything, it would be, you guys like Phantasm, right? Have you seen all those movies? And it is absolutely hitting my fucking homage retro G-spot for sure. Like, it's tickling all the right places for me. I've totally enjoyed it. And as far as this episode goes, I think we have, and we'll talk about it when we get there, maybe the most important scene of the series so far in this episode. And it is definitely between Joyce and Hopper.
I love this
episode is such a blast. And it has such, all of them kind of have a cliffhangery note, but this one is I'm left wondering what's going to happen to even our main characters, like how they're not in like a who's going to die, who's going to make it sense, but like how are the relationships even going to exist after this? Like what, it's going to be different. It's a more like emotional cliffhanger. And I love it. This is a great, great episode.
Well, that was crap. Jessica, you want to fill in for that?
Yeah.
Just teasing. Wow. Good stuff. Thanks, Matthew. I appreciate that. It's funny you say Phantasm. It didn't even occur to me because I haven't seen Phantasm in a long time. But here's what I'll tell you. Phantasm was scary when I was a kid. I just remember that man walking in slow motion.
Boy!
Yes, that was terrifying to me. I seem to remember this wacky floating ball of death. Is that Phantasm? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The right. Silvery balls with little blades sticking out of them.
Yes, that's the one. That's all I really remember. So I'm going to have to revisit Phantasm. I know that's something we talked about bonus wise for science fiction, but we might come back to that. So, Jessica, I don't know if you want to piggyback off of that or do your own thing, but why don't you just give me some overall, high level thoughts here?
I just think it's funny that Matthew, well, I don't think it's funny, but Matthew said one of the most important scenes and it involved Hopper and Joyce. And we just rewatched the episode, and during what I'm assuming is the scene that you're talking about, I started to try to tell Dean something, and he's like, don't talk, save it for the podcast. So I have the feeling we might have similar feelings on that.
I also feel like that's got to be 30% of you guys' conversations in real life is, shut up, save it for the podcast.
Oh my God, you don't even know, it's terrible.
Yeah,
we can't have a real conversation without microphones.
That's pretty.
You
fun.
Even just pants about, even if they're unplugged, you got to hold them in front of each other just to have a heart to heart.
Exactly.
Awesome. I'm like, I wish I could lower you. I wish I could mute you. I don't know.
I can't quit you.
Yeah, man. This show continues to impress me. I keep waiting for it to fall apart. I keep wondering that with all these complex things that are going on, it appears that I'm just waiting for it to shit the bed. And that is the pessimist in me, which unfortunately rears its ugly head at times. And I have this, I don't know what it is. Perhaps it's some sort of weird guilty conscience. Perhaps it's because I'm fucked up and have lots of mental problems. But there are times where I'm just waiting for the wheels to come off of things, right? That happens to me. And I think that's just the darkness in my personality. Like, I think that about our LSG media in general. I just keep waiting. I'm like, all right, I'm going to wake up tomorrow. All our shows are going to be kicked off of iTunes for some reason. Like, I have this weird thing where I'm like, is this really happening? Is this really happening? Is this fun? And I've had it happen to me a couple times. You know, when I was watching The Force Awakens, I remember thinking, is this as good as I think it is? I'm just waiting for...
When's it
going to
start sucking? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fucked up thing that I don't know why I have that in my mind.
Oh,
I
Dean,
know.
Oh, God. True Detective really messed you up then.
Yeah, exactly. Scott Cummings in the chat says, you're from Massachusetts. That's how we all feel. Guess we're all a bunch of dark souls up here in the Northeast, I suppose. Cynics to the bitter end. But I am still impressed with the way the show moves. I mean, I am impressed with some of the character dynamics we've seen. I like some of the flip-flopping that we're seeing between characters, and I mean that in a positive way. I know that's usually used in a pejorative, but some of the stuff between Hopper and Joyce, the parallels, speaking of parallels, there's a lot of metaphorical parallels in this episode in addition to the physical parallels of other dimensions, and I'm looking forward to getting into some of that stuff. And the other shoe hasn't dropped, and maybe it never will. Maybe they just... fucking took that shoe, threw it in the upside down world and called it a day. But that's how I'm feeling. I'm feeling good. And I was impressed again. Another episode that was impressive.
Yeah. And I feel like there have been no real missteps at all. Nothing I would see it that way.
You know, I think there's a bonus in that when you know the end of what you're trying to do and you have 8 episodes to work with, you can make it work. When you have a definitive beginning and middle and end and you've worked it out and you have it set up and it's going to play for 8 episodes, you're doing a good service. I think this is why True Detective Season 1 was so good. They knew exactly how it was going to end. They knew how it was going to start. They had an entire show. And that's why I think when shows go, oh, we got renewed and now we got to fucking come up with more stories. It's the same old tale of the band's first album is the best album or maybe their second album. And then when they're rich and in mansions, you don't care about what they're crying about anymore. You just stop. It's not the same feeling. It doesn't have that same thing. Jessica's waving her hand, go ahead.
This is true, and this is something that I believe, I don't know if it was the writers or somebody on the show, they specifically made reference to the television show The Killing. I don't know if either of you ever watched it. It's a great TV show. The first season is phenomenal.
Yeah.
They didn't know if there was going to be a second season, so it was made as if like the first season could be standalone and it could be the end. When they got a second season, they were like, ooh, we kind of answered our main question at the end, but we're going to actually flip it around, and that wasn't right, so we can make a whole second season about it too.
Right.
With the same mystery, basically. Mm-hmm. And the people from this show are like, we don't want this to be The Killing. Whether we get renewed or not, we're not going to do what they did.
I like it.
And I think that that's smart about the way that this show has gone about things.
Yeah, it's funny.
I know I'm jumping ahead, and I don't want to talk about this right now, but I want us to all be thinking about, maybe this would be a good discussion for a post-discussion of the show, but how do we feel about a second season of this show? Because I feel like this is one of those situations. I mean, we haven't even finished it, but it does feel kind of like lightning captured in a bottle. And this is a story that has been stirring around in the Duffer Brothers' head for a long time. They've been honing it, probably revising it for years and years and years, and it's a success. And how does season two play out? And now there's the pressure to continue on, have the success. Let's be thinking about that. Let's think about what we – do we really want that or not?
I agree, and I think –
let's ask True Detective season two what they think about that.
Vince Vaughn, do you have anything to say?
He's in season two of Stranger Things, okay, guys? He's already been cast.
Your money, baby. Your money. Who's the big winner tonight? Mikey's the big winner. All right. I don't. Is that what he says? Yeah, that's Swingers. But no, you know, it's funny. When I contrast it against shows that are notoriously better as they go on is Star Trek, right? It's because they are trying to find their footing. They're trying to develop their characters because there really is no definitive end. So as a result, you have to grow into loving the characters. And I think personally that I don't think there's a Star Trek season I've seen where I thought it got worse as it went on. I thought they all got better as they went on. Season 3 and 4 really hit their strides, especially in Next Gen and in DS9. And I wonder if that's because there really isn't a definitive end. They're like, let's make Star Trek again. Boom. And then you start to get a feel for the characters. The actors start to get a feel for the characters. There's no definitive end. And it's a little bit different. Yeah, until season 7, Mr. Bucket says in the chat. That's true. But
show,
I don't know.
Except for Game of Thrones, like, goes downhill after season 6, though, I feel.
Yeah, yeah. I think there is
sometimes
a breaking point.
Season 5, arguably.
Yeah, I think there's a breaking point for sure. Diminishing returns start to occur when you start to get that. When you get the impression that the actors have had it, the writing staff has had it, or at least the producers have had it, and they're just like, we're done. Like,
I feel like the single best example, other than True Detective, of a show that had a stellar first season and then just slowly trekked downhill was Prison Break.
Oh. I never watched it, but I heard that the first season is so good. Like, I've heard
so
that.
So good. So good. And the second season is immediately like 50% worse.
Wow.
Like, right from the jump. It's like, oh, they shouldn't have continued.
All right. Well, without further ado, let's break into Stranger Things Chapter 5, The Flea and the Acrobats.
Here's where things get really interesting. The flea can also travel this way, along the side of the rope. He can even go underneath the rope.
Upside down.
Exactly.
But we're not the flea, we're the acrobat.
In this metaphor, yes, we're the acrobat.
So we can't go upside down?
No.
Well, is there any way for the acrobat to get to the upside down?
Well, you'd have to create a massive amount of energy, more than humans are currently capable of creating, mind you, to open up some kind of tear in time and space. And then... you create a doorway.
Like a gate?
Sure, like a gate. But again, this is all...
theoretical. But what if this gate already existed?
Well, if it did, I think we'd know. It would disrupt gravity, the magnetic field, our environment. Heck, it might even swallow us up whole. Science is neat, but I'm afraid it's not very forgiving.
Okay, well, we open things up kind of where we left off, the Hawkins lab. Mm-hmm. We see Hopper going full James Bond infiltration style.
Fucking Splinter Cell up in here.
Splinter Cell. Yeah, I really wanted him to be hanging upside down with night vision goggles.
I actually really wanted to shoot his silenced
pistol.
When the cops see him, I wanted to hear the Solid Snake fucking exclamation point go over their head. You've been seen.
Yeah. You have to use more stealth. But yeah, he's infiltrating. I like that we there's a lot of upside down world parallels in this, and that's one of the things I happen to notice about this episode, and I think it starts right here. First, it seems like he's in a regular lab, right? It's people walking around in white coats. They're talking. They seem like they just want to be done with their shift and go home to their families. They got their clipboards. They're having their regular lives like any other business that you would observe. Mm-hmm. But then we start to see the upside down world, metaphorically, because we see the biohazard sign. We see the barrier. And then he's like, oh, well, fuck it. And he breaks through into the place and he starts to creep around. He gets a couple of guys, put guns on him. He talks his way into being able to surprise and subdue both men, grabs the key card, and shoots the lock mechanism a la Star Wars. What do you guys think of this opening scene, Jessica?
I think there's something that I really like, and I can remember this from my notes about the last two episodes. I can't remember if every episode was this way. And I don't know if it's because they dropped them all at once, but I love that every episode opens exactly where we left off from the last one. Like, there's no fucking around with going somewhere else. It's like, we see Hopper going to break into the lab, and our next episode is going to start with him in the lab.
Right.
And I hope that the next episode starts with Nancy in the upside down world. You know what I mean? And last week, it was the same thing. It continues where we end on this cliffhanger, oh my God, and we open right back on it. I love that the show does that, because I feel like a lot of shows don't.
Bury the lead.
Like, to open where they, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems to be a trope now, right? Burying the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've said, you know what? We're not going to do that. We're going to bring you right back where we were and not goof off. We're not going to string you along, because it's distracting. It's when you do bury the lead, a lot of times what's happening is you're watching the scenes ahead of it, just waiting for the scene you know is coming. So it's almost like a distraction. They're like, you know what? No distractions. Right back to the Hawkins lab to see Hopper doing his Splinter Cell shit.
Oh, yeah. I love, you know, we see it a little bit in the past episode of once, basically we see this turn in Hopper. Once he meets that guy at the bar, once he starts seeing that there's something bigger underneath the, you know, immediately obvious elements and starts investigating, goes to the morgue. It's really when he goes to the morgue and fucking knocks that guy's lights out and starts going and trying to find the body. And then he goes to the lab where we have seen him. I like that he is just unhesitating and unflinching in this. Like I like that there's no debate among him or anybody else about, like, well, this could ruin my life. Like, I don't know. He's just like, fuck it. Like, and we see that much more throughout this episode of how he's ready to just like scuttle the rest of his life in the pursuit of solving this. And I like, you can even see it in his response with these guards, you know, the cop who stops him. He's just like, no hesitation. Like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Hey, yeah, it's me. And I'm supposed to be here. Like, just totally cool and collected about it. Like, I feel like he is borderline ready to like die for this. Like, he doesn't even care. He's like fully invested at this point.
That's the impression I'm getting as well, actually. I think that he has resigned himself to this sacrifice. He wasn't able to save his daughter, right? His daughter died.
We still don't know how, but something.
We don't know how, but we do know that he lost his child, which of course is the worst thing anyone can ever experience.
Yeah.
And he has, now he's in a position where he has this chance again. And now that he knows, once he found Teddy Bear Will in the morgue, right? Once he opened that slab and pulled stuffing out of Teddy Bear Will.
Build-A-Will.
He was like,
the Build-A-Will at the Build-A-Will workshop.
Build-A-Will.
Life like necrosis. For $14.99, you can add things too, like the birthmark.
And also, for $3 extra, you can give him an Evil Dead hat.
Yes.
There is that.
And for only $4 more, you can have his wizard pewter model used in this Dungeons & Dragons game.
I cast Fireball.
Fight the Gorgon.
Oh, my God.
What should I do?
Now he talks like Mickey Mouse.
Now all our listeners are like, this is how Matthew derails shows. Okay. This is my introduction to him. Cool.
So then, but no, I think you're right. I think he said, I couldn't save my daughter, but I for sure can save this kid. And I don't care if it brings about my ruin. I think he's ready to sacrifice himself for Will because he can't have his daughter back. And that's a regret of his. There's going to be a part of him, and there's a part of every parent who loses a kid feeling somehow responsible, right?
Yeah.
Somehow, I mean, outside of, I mean, I would guess any, I have no idea what that's like. I'm talking right out of my ass, right? the microphone is right up against my ass and I'm talking out of it because I don't know what I'm talking about here.
Because you're Ace Ventura.
But I have to imagine. Right. Let me ask you a few questions. There has to be a level of guilt in that. And for sure, I think we're seeing him. There's a redemption possibility for Hopper. And it might lead to his death. I don't discount a dead Hopper by the end of this. Especially with the phone call that we're going to get to. But I like this. I like how he is unhesitating. I like how he has a bit of a Han Solo to him. He kind of talks his way into taking these guys out. So he's a fast talker, but he's also physical when he needs to be. It was very,
very Han Solo-esque. Very,
and not yeah. to mention the shooting of the fucking door thing, the access
Han
thing.
Solo.
That's Star Wars to a T. How many of those did Leia and Luke shoot between them? Like a dozen?
Absolutely. And I don't know about you guys. You know, David Harbour is one of those actors, you know, the guy who plays Hopper. He's been in a lot of things. He's one of those character actors who's just been in a lot of movies, but he's very often villainous or a bad guy or a corrupt politician. He was in, I saw recently, The Equalizer with Denzel Washington. He's this, Ooh. Like, corrupt cop in that he very often plays shitty people. And it's really interesting to see him get to be a main character here and flesh out sure. the, like, heart of gold good guy. And he fucking nails it.
Wow. It's actually fascinating. I'm just, like, looking through his stuff and I don't even recognize him as the same person when he's not Hopper. Like, I'm right. just looking at his IMDb page and things that he's in, which, by the way, he's in Suicide Squad, if anyone has seen that.
He's in Black Mass.
Yep. Now I can picture that in my head. Shit. And it's so funny because I thought he was somebody I'd never seen in anything before. Like, even, like, Revolutionary Road. Like, I've seen that movie. I remember him in that now that I'm thinking about it. But he's so... I don't know. Like, he's like a whole different person to me. It's weird.
Yeah, he's good.
He just doesn't look the same.
It's like he's an actor. She swigs her drink.
I'm going to murder Dean one day.
I'm just waiting for one of these podcasts where I hear the drink actually splash into Dean's face.
It could happen. It
could happen.
Oh, he was in the play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? If anyone wants.
I am very much afraid of her.
Actor!
So we move over to Joyce and Lonnie. This was... I didn't expect this at first, but I guess it sets up the flip-flop we're seeing between Joyce mm-hmm. and Hopper, which was Joyce can't feel Will anymore. That was concerning to me. She jumps at Lonnie, who looks at her like she's out of her mind, and Lonnie suggests that maybe she's a little cuckoo like Aunt Darlene, right? Aunt Darlene was a little cuckoo. Maybe you're cuckoo too. It's possible.
I love how this whole time he's being like, you know, maybe you do have to accept that maybe your head's messing with you and you're not right. And he's also like, but you should also drink. You should probably drink really hard right now. That'll be good.
Oh, I know. Just feeding her the booze. That's my exact note.
He's probably just trying to get
feeding
laid.
Feeding her booze. Oh, like, that. Joyce, here, just drink this hard liquor right out of this large cup. Like it's water.
He's hoping to fall into the old rhythms, you know?
Ugh. I hate
he knows
this
what
guy.
She likes. Fucking... He knows what she likes. And what's... It's just easier.
And you know what? This is one of those times as an audience member, it's easy to be so thoroughly on Joyce's side because we know the truth. We know we've seen the monster. We know Will is in the upside down dimension and we know she's right. But it is also important to remember that in any normal circumstance, if it really was that her son went missing and he got killed and she was saying and doing all these things, that's really bad. Like, she's really good. She would be really off her rocker. And it's not unreasonable for a person to be like, maybe you should consider seeing a therapist or, like, you know, maybe, like, you got to consider these options for yourself. But the way he does it is so scummy. Like, it's still just so gross.
Exactly.
When you look back on the scene, you know, knowing his motivation for being here, you know, hindsight's 20/20, right? We understand why he's there. He's going under the cover of actually caring when in fact he doesn't. He's there to make a few bucks.
Right.
Apparently he's in debt, which we're going to learn later. But to your point, I don't think he's being completely unreasonable here.
Yeah.
He's saying, listen to yourself. Fake bodies. Will's in the wall. You busted a hole in the wall. How do you explain this? You need to talk to somebody. He's not being unreasonable here. He's being completely reasonable outside of anything that we would imagine is going on here.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he doesn't really seem broken up, though, which is the issue. He doesn't seem broken up about his kid being gone.
Right.
And that's the only, he seems very ambivalent to the whole thing about Will being dead. That's what troubles me is wondering how really connected to Will he is.
Definitely.
Obviously not very much, since he said that Will was a fairy and like basically made fun of him when he was alive.
Yeah.
So he doesn't seem like, you know, the best parental figure of all time.
No, not really.
I'll throw that out there.
Yeah, tough. So we go back. Kill something.
We move back.
Yeah, exactly. You kill a rabbit.
We move back to the Hawkins lab, and this is the beginning of some intercuts between the Wheelers and the lab, which we're going to talk about, and we'll sort of discuss them. So Hopper is actively calling out for Will. This is a huge thing. This is him going, okay, Will's alive. I get it. Enough to where I'm going to call out for the kid physically.
Yeah. Yeah. He's expecting
that's important.
At this point, he's almost expecting him to be held there like a prisoner or something. And I feel like when he sees this drawing, you know, that's a big, it really hovers on his reaction here. When he sees the little drawing of a kid and somebody said called Papa, he really stares hard at that. And I'm wondering if here he's actually, you know, thinking that maybe this is had been done by Will and he's somewhere still in this facility.
Right. I like that. And it is, we only know what he has said and what he has done. And what he's done has shown that he's curious about what's going on at the Hawkins lab. What he's done is he found, you know, Teddy Bear Will. So we know he knows there's some fuckery afoot. But now when he actively calls out to him, which is what he's done in the presence of nobody, we know that he really believes that Will is alive, or at least he hopes he is, and that he's moving around searching for him. But he does find the kid's room, some drawings of Eleven, Papa, and of course the kitty that Papa was trying to get Eleven to blow up.
And as far as like Hopper knows and seeing these things, he could think that that was Will in there drawing something. You know what I mean?
Because
don't forget, every picture Elle draws of herself shows short hair too.
Yep, absolutely.
So I think there's, or he could also be thinking back to the idea of the woman with the missing kid from the earlier episode that we talked about, who was discredited, but this also.
Indeed. Ooh. Yeah, that's. It's funny that we saw that then and how his partners at the time thought that she was just crazy and he wasn't so sure. Now he's really falling into it. So back at the Wheelers, they're trying to figure out what Will was saying. I guess Mel and Elle mentions upside down. Mike figures it out based on the game board. And we get this whole scene here where Elle says, you know, he took us to the house. What if he was there, but we couldn't see him? What if he was on the other side?
Mike is in there saying, they ask him, like, what did he say? And he just says, like home, but dark
like
and
home,
empty.
Yeah.
And cold, maybe, but maybe not. We're not sure if he said cold. I like that. Like, I think it's Dustin just adds that. And cold. Or maybe he didn't say cold.
Yeah.
Like, he just makes it up.
Being very
Dustin
literal.
Then brings up the Veil of Shadows. Mm-hmm. Now, I think this is brilliantly filmed. We have Dustin talking about the Veil of Shadows, which becomes a voiceover for Hawkins Lab. As Hopper runs around, we have alarms going off. It's very intense. We get more Veil of Shadows talk. It becomes the voiceover playing out of phase, playing of monsters. It's right in front of you, and you can't even see it. Dustin suggests that they can cast Shadow Walk, right? Can't we just do that, guys?
Yeah, just like the game pieces.
Yeah, just pull out your real-life wizard wand.
Seems logical.
I got a staff of the Magi around here somewhere. I'm sure I can cast that. So the kids decide that they need to get there. This is the beauty of this show right here. I think this is my favorite part of this show is the kids, and that is their complete and utter faith in all of this stuff being possible.
Yeah.
There is an innocence to that I just think is beautiful and that I love. They need to get there, and they are so convinced it's real and that they can get there that they decide that's where they need to go. They're fearless.
Yeah.
They have that naive nature that makes them say, we're just going to go there, right? No problem. And they ask Elle. Of course, she doesn't answer because we know later that she's terrified.
Hey, Elle, you can shadow walk, right? You'll take care of this for us, huh?
Yeah. What level are you? Hopper finds the wall creature portal. Which we've seen before, whatever you want to call it.
Last time we saw it, it was eating a scientist. No big deal.
Poor Shepard.
One thing I feel like Shepard. We got to note, one of the big, whenever we see, I guess, you know, because we get a glimpse of Barb in the Upside Down at this point, all we see in the Upside Down universe is those floating specks in the air. I feel like that's a pretty big visual cue of when you are in the Upside Down. And when Hopper goes in the elevator, when he's up in the, or, you know, I guess higher parts of the lab, it's still normal. It gets darker, but it's normal. And he gets on the elevator, goes down to where the big, you know, wall monster vagina is, and there's floating specks everywhere, which makes me think that getting into the elevator and going to the lower floor is the Upside Down. Like, that's another, that the elevator's a gateway itself, and he's actually in it.
Awesome. Well, he does reach for it. I like this tense moment. Of course, we saw Shepard's face, so we're all screaming at the TV, don't do it, Hopper, don't do it. It's a tense moment. It's interrupted by a quick movement behind him, and then he gets overwhelmed by the scientist, which sounds funny. But they do, they manage to sedate him with some kind of syringe full of, I don't even know what.
Something.
Something.
Oh, God.
Bang, that's the opening credits, which is great. I mean, what a way to kick things off. The way they tease these intros, the scenes that they shoot prior to the credits are great. They have you hooked. You're ready to go.
Oh, yeah.
Which is
yeah.
funny because I love the opening credits, too.
So. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This is a show I do not skip the opening credit. I want to hear that song every time.
Every time. There are very few shows like that.
We go right back to Joyce and Lonnie. A nice tracking shot on the lights as the credits play over. And Jonathan comes home. And I love the shot of Jonathan's POV of Joyce with the blanket over her shoulders, yeah. holding a cup.
Kind of leaning
sitting
onto
next
him.
To Lonnie. Ugh. Ugh. That's brutal for Jonathan.
Oh, yeah.
That's such a great shot. And it makes me just realize poor Jonathan in this situation. And this is rough. This is a rough moment for Jonathan to find himself in.
And this, you know, I want to talk about his character a little bit here because of anybody in this show, I mean, obviously Joyce is having a super hard time. But to think about Jonathan's position, I feel like he has maybe the hardest of anybody in this show. He's the youngest who is also in the very first episode. I've rewatched the first episode two additional times now. And there's that quick scene right after Will disappears and we see the glimpse inside of Joyce and Jonathan's house. But he's saying he took another shift at his job for their bills. Like, he's a kid right. in high school and helping mm-hmm. pay their bills. And I'm like, there's no one. There are no other characters on this show who have had to grow up as fast as him. I feel so hard for this kid.
Me too. Yeah. I love him.
What the fuck's he been waiting for, the goddamn shitless layabout? How old is he now? It's goddamn 16, 17. Should have been in that factory when he was 11.
He should have been shooting rabbits when he was 6, fucking paying the mortgage age 9.
Yeah. Hey, my fucking shoes ain't going to fix themselves, kid. Get to work.
Good Lord.
God damn it.
You don't get a weekend. You don't get no weekend yeah. hours. I busted up them unions.
Yeah, that's right. Jimmy Hoffa's a fucking pair of hubcaps. All right. So anyway, now that we're done talking about unions, Joyce tells Jonathan that Dad's going to be staying here tonight on the couch, she quickly says. And I like this because we're seeing Jonathan converted. It wasn't that long ago where Joyce and Jonathan were arguing in the street about Will's funeral.
Yeah.
That thing in there? She's not going to have a funeral for that thing in there. But now she doesn't feel Will's presence. There's a bit of doubt creeping into Joyce.
There is.
And Jonathan believes now. And this is what I mean by these flip-flopping scenarios. We have Hopper, which we're going to learn in a minute. And now we have Jonathan saying, oh, no, I know what's going on here. He's pretty confident at this point that it is not, in fact, Will. Because he asks Mom about that thing. Doesn't he? What is his words here again, Jessica? He said something like, did that thing come back? Or he asks her about the thing specifically, doesn't he? Matthew,
so.
You have the episode on, don't you?
Yeah, I'm trying to find exactly what you're talking about. I don't remember him exactly.
I think he says, did the thing come back?
Yeah.
And that's when Lonnie says, listen, your mom's sick, dude. She took down a wall with an axe.
He does say, yeah, I remember what Lonnie says of like, don't play into her delusions. Like he's saying, yes. don't be on her side here because that's going to be bad for her because he thinks she's crazy. And then he says to take down that Evil Dead poster. It's inappropriate, which fucking pissed me off so much.
Before that, he basically tells Jonathan to behave himself at the funeral.
Brutal.
Oh. He comes in and says, I'm a hero and I am rescuing you guys. You better behave and take down that Evil Dead poster.
Yeah, I don't want to reduce Lonnie to a simple two-dimensional character.
But we just have to.
But he's not, you know, he's not winning any approval ratings for me because I hate this behavior of you can't waltz back into this kid's yeah. life, think you're going to take charge and start telling him things like take down his posters. What?
Yeah, crazy.
Go fuck yourself, dude.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? You can't just waltz back into my life and start telling me how to live my life.
That's how absentee parents are when they return, I'm
it
pretty
sucks.
Sure.
Like, come on, stop.
That's the thing. Like, I don't
pretend like they've been there the whole time.
Right.
Those bastards.
Like, I don't blame them for coming back and trying to want to be there.
Sure.
But like the whole, like, this isn't your house. You don't live here. You don't have say over here. You are essentially a guest again. You're not daddy in his kingdom anymore. Like, you are a guest here. You don't get to fucking make rules anymore.
Yeah.
Such a dick.
Hey, Dad. go fucking pound sand. How about Will thought that poster was awesome? Go fuck yourself. Like, get out of here with your sensitivities.
And it's in his room. It's not like he's like, look, Mom, right. Maybe Will got pulled into hell just like this poster.
He wears an Evil Dead t-shirt to the funeral.
He starts showing images of Will's dead body. He's like, here, pass it down. He starts handing out photos of dead Will.
Real?
It's so fucking metal, right?
Cue up the double bass.
Then I would have to be on Lonnie's side. Yeah, this is a little inappropriate, son.
Behave yourself.
Well, we get this funeral prep scene, which is pretty dark, but
so sad. I drew so many sad faces
in my
notes.
It's sad, but we have the benefit of the POV of the kids. We get to laugh in this moment in the funeral where Dustin's like, oh my God, this girl's crying for him, right? That comes up here. That's Jennifer Hayes or something.
That's something I like about what the show is able to do is like, this is very dark watching them get ready for the funeral. Andrew Gaskin in the chat said, it really hits you in the feels when you see that Jonathan can't tie his tie because he doesn't have YouTube or a dad. Which is true. That's and really so sad.
That's so sad and true. And Dean just roars and laughs.
That's amazing.
But it's true. Yeah. And I like that kind of filmmaking, it's so subtle. It's not like we don't see him wistfully looking over his shoulder at his dad who's like off drinking. We just see him trying to tie his tie and it's not working. And you can, it's like, oh yeah, fuck. He's the only one who like has nobody to teach him this shit.
Son, I told you if you bring home a brace of conies and one fox pelt, I would teach you how to tie a tie.
Because we do see Mike's dad, you know, Mr. Creepo over there, helping him get ready, correct?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because he has to keep up appearances. That's what serial killers do.
I love that you guys see him as a serial killer, and I just see him as completely lobotomized.
Precisely. The only time his blood pressure goes up is when he's choking the life out of some poor runaway.
All right, so what did I do? What I do other than strangle a hitchhiker?
I bet you're regretting that you got on that bus. He's fucking strangling her.
Oh my God.
Jesus.
Yeah. Guys, can I also mention, like, it was really sad when, like, the dog went to the little castle in the woods and he laid down, he whimpered. Oh my God, that's obviously that touched my heart. Oh, yeah. And I hugged my dog and said...
But I like how we have this. It's like a boom shot where the shot comes in over the top of the funeral people and it settles down. And of course, the coffin enters the frame and we move. We have this panning shot across the faces. We're establishing all this sadness. Joyce kind of has a blank expression. And then we settle on the kids. They're just kind of smiling. And you're like, yes, thank you.
Yes.
The editing of these episodes is outstanding. Their timing is so good. They don't want you to settle too long on these sad tones. They don't want these tonal things to creep too much into the narrative. They want to remind you that the kids still believe, and that's what makes it so fun. The kids believed, and then we had the fake out where we thought Will was dead, but we blew that up right away in the very next episode. And now we're seeing their perspective. It must be this nice sense of peace. Like, you know, you believe that Will is out there, and they laugh at the fact that this little girl, Jennifer Hayes, is crying for Will and how he's going to get such a kick out of that.
Yeah.
I love it.
Because that obviously means that it's like they are anticipating future conversations with Will.
Yes.
It would be like, hey, dude, at your funeral, she was crying. It was
This goes back to that phenomenon in war where they talked about this in World War II, where guys would do crazy shit to get themselves souvenirs because it was a subconscious thing that said that if you have a souvenir, it means you're going to get home safely from the war and be able to enjoy it.
Wasn't that like Band of Brothers?
Yeah. Band of Brothers, right. I think it was Malarkey was the guy's name. True story. But he would do crazy shit. He'd run out, I got a Luger. I've always wanted one of these, right? And he's going to bring it home from the war, which is a suggestion, or you could almost say, could it be a self-fulfilling prophecy that you believe so strongly that you're going to be able to enjoy this souvenir that you've taken from a war in France that you're going to survive. And it reminded me of that when I was watching this scene.
And one guy always ruins all the fun with his necklace of ears.
So rude, honestly.
Just so, come on, man. We were having a good time picking up guns. You had to take it too far.
I like it. You are disgusting. So Joyce talks to Will about his D&D wizard, which I fucking love.
Yeah.
This is the line where she says, well, if he's so wise, he can't he outsmart the bad guys? And Will says, yeah, normally, but sometimes the bad guys are smart too.
I love it. It just shows how smart the kid is. Will's such a smart kid.
And it's also obviously foreshadowing to what's going on in his life right now.
And you know, I want to go on a little tangent here. I want to see if you guys picked up on this, because I've watched the first episode, like I said, like probably 3 or 4 times now. I keep introducing the show to people, so I watch the episode with them. but one thing I've noticed, you know, because we've seen Barb go into the world. We've seen other people just get pulled up and killed immediately. We've seen the deer just get chomped apart as soon as they're pulled into the upside down. So I imagine we're all, after we watch the first episode, like, well, fuck, how does he survive this? He gets pulled into the upside down by the monster. Isn't it just going to immediately eviscerate him? Like, how could he survive? In the first episode, he gets taken with his gun in hand. When Hopper goes back into the shed, the gun's not there. He picks up the box of bullets. The rifle's not there. And he loaded maybe, I think, 4 or 5 shots into the clip and popped it into the gun. I have the feeling, whenever we get to kind of learn what happened, what has come of Will, and that he's been able to hide out there, it's because at first he was able to get off some shots with his gun and then go hide. And I feel like this scene, talking about the wizard, even though the wizard's smart and can talk his way out of things and can maneuver and hide, sometimes he's still got to shoot. I feel like that's tossing us a bone of, like, he had a moment, you know, a moment with that gun to get off a shot, maybe wound it, and run and hide. I feel like that's going to be what we see happens.
Yep.
This is a question. This is kind of off topic, but, like, do we think we're ever going to see Barb again, or do we think Barb is dead?
I think we're going to see Barb again.
I'm starting to think she might be dead.
We might see her dead. That's possible.
Like, I don't know. I think if anyone gets out of it, it might only be Will.
Damn.
Yeah.
R.I.P. Barb.
That means R.I.P. Nancy.
And Jonathan.
Oh, yeah. Fuck Nancy.
Jesus Christ. Just kill everybody, why don't you? Now you're getting to Stephen King territory.
I want Nancy to hook up with Jonathan. God, this is so hard. So hard.
Wow. Nothing gives her the vapors more than high school sex.
You can't appreciate 80s horror without sweaty high school sex.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah. The only thing that makes me not feel guilty about talking about it is the fact that I know they're adults for real.
They're like 27. It's fine. Yeah. They're older than Matthew.
Jonathan has 3 kids. Will you watch it around that mic?
I don't know why, but Dean just really started like waving his hands at me so angrily. And I don't understand.
So Hopper wakes up at home.
Like he went on a bender.
Oh, yeah.
Basically.
Pills, booze. He grabs a pistol, runs outside, runs back inside. Starts to examine his neck for, of course, the puncture wound that we know he remembers. He then begins to tear his house apart, looking for surveillance bugs. Does this not remind anyone else of Joyce's intense mission to put up lights all over her house?
There we go. And not only, I mean, it's almost even further than Joyce, because like I was saying earlier, this is like where we see him totally throwing his life in the trash can, just saying like, fuck it, like, I don't care about my home, I don't care about my stuff, I don't care about my reputation anymore. He is totally fine and unhesitating in just ripping his literal house and life apart for this.
Nice.
So true.
I think that it's kind of cool that we get to see Hopper experience clues that continue to drive him forward. We saw the microfiche. We saw the hospital gown stuff. We saw him get to the lab. We saw him uncovering the Stades being part of this, pushing the town medical examiner off the case. All of these things, every time he continues to find clues, it just continues to push him forward. And then he finds another one. Of course, he does find a surveillance bug in his light. So now he's really believing things are crazy.
And that's what I was going to say, too, is we could have gone through this whole thing and there could have not been a bug in his house and we still would have known and he still would have known. But I like that they give us that. Like, okay, he wasn't crazy with this idea.
Yeah.
You know? It's not a hallucination.
They're
giving us something and they're giving us more with him than with Joyce almost. Like with Joyce, it's like, okay, yes, we see her communicating with her son who's maybe dead or in another dimension, but those are all weird things. With Hopper, they're like, here's like concrete evidence.
That's a great point.
It's going to come together between the two of them.
We get a quick look in on the monitoring room as he yanks that surveillance bug out of his light. And we see Brenner, right? Did I say it right this time?
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. He hears Will say something like, Mom, it's coming. He concludes that she, meaning Elle, was there. So now Brenner believes that Will is hooked up with our main characters, which I'm sure is going to push his investigation forward. We move back over to the graveyard. Jonathan and Nancy track the creature's movements by way of a map. They know that it's not traveling far, and they decide that, well, it's going to be in this area. Here's what we're going to do. Here's an idea. We're going to kill it.
Oof.
Great idea.
We're going to kill it.
You're a bunch of teenagers.
And then Jonathan goes to his dad's, I think, sweet fucking car. I think it's a GTO. It's so nice.
It does look nice.
And he hawks his old man's pistol. And this is the first of a couple more callbacks to Stand By Me. This was Christopher, I think, played by River Phoenix. Hawks his old man's pistol in Stand By Me. And they have it, and they use it in the end to scare off Kiefer Sutherland before they find Ray Bowers, or whatever the fuck his name is. We went through this last time.
Dean watches Stand By Me every night before he goes to sleep. If you guys were wondering how he knows it so well.
Waiting for a pie-eating contest in this episode, in this fucking show. But
good Lord.
Yeah, steals his old man's pistol. That's such an 80s thing. Movies nowadays wouldn't have the balls to show a kid steal a gun for good.
every dad back then, you could just push aside their bottle of whiskey and their cigarettes and find a pistol. It's always
That's right. And you know what? They fucking lived, you bunch of fucking Hollywood liberal cunts. Jonathan agrees. Sorry about that. I take it back. I love you guys. Nancy doesn't love the idea, obviously. She thinks that Joyce should probably know. And that's what I love is that Jonathan's sitting on what he believes is evidence about this. They could bring it to mom and she could not feel crazy. But he says, not yet. I want to kill this thing. I want to, again.
She's been through enough.
So what do we see happening again? Classic Jonathan. Deciding that he's going to absorb responsibility to keep his family safe. This is the older kid without the parent, taking on the parent role. He wants to keep Joyce from having to deal with this shit. And I like that. This is consistent with the Jonathan character up until this point.
Yeah.
So, pretty wild.
Now, anyway, is this the moment we get the repairman from the Department of Energy showing up at the school?
Mm-hmm.
Just about. Oh. Yes. Yep. So Jonathan agrees. After the monster is dead, they're going to tell him. An agent inspects the Heath kit, and this is the state agent you're referring to, Matthew.
Yeah.
He then, there's a part here which makes me think that Mr. Clark might be in danger.
Mr. Clark is a bad guy. The end.
Can I talk now?
Yeah, I guess.
Now, why do you guys hate Mr. Clark so much?
It's just me. It's just me. I don't know. I just got a bad feeling.
You know what, Jessica?
Him.
I'm gonna have to say, I don't think it's Mr. Clark you don't trust. I think it's his mustache.
Does not help. It does confuse me a little.
The man shaves and he's a perfectly nice, respectable teacher.
I'm like, oh, I love Mr. Clark. Good
you
work.
You guys done sucking each other's dicks, so I was trying to make a point.
I'll roll out the red carpet for Big Billy Podcast over here.
Yeah, right. You know what? Give me my fucking podium, you sons of bitches. No, what I'm trying to say is this. When the state agent says, Mr. Clark, huh? Like, almost like, okay, now Mr. Clark's on a list. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like he might be in danger now.
I thought he was saying Mr. Clark, huh? Because he knows
Our
Mr.
Plant.
Clark's working for him.
Ooh, yeah. I like that take. That's sexy.
I'm just anti-Mr. Clark. Just like I'm anti-Mr. Wheeler. I'm pretty sure they murder hookers together.
I'm for sure anti-Mr. Wheeler because that guy has a stack of runaways under his house. A stack of runaways in that crawl space.
Good God. I like Mr.
Coming
Clark.
Along nicely.
I think he's cool.
Yeah, well, now we can add Barb's hair to his fucking Franken-hooker that he's making.
Franken-hooker.
Jesus.
It's possible. So, funeral reception time. The kids talk to Mr. Clark, and we get a...
Obviously. Mr. Clark.
We soon get an Event Horizon explanation of Wormhole.
Yes!
God.
Yeah, we do.
We sure do.
Love it.
I love Event Horizon.
So we start talking parallel universes, Veil of Shadows. Mr. Clark offers the acrobat.
Theoretically.
The tightrope and the flea. He says, look, we're the acrobat. We can move forward and backwards. The flea can do the same, except they can also travel alongside the rope or under. And the kids all say, upside down.
Why can fleas do that, not humans? It doesn't seem fair.
They ask about the flea. You have to tear time and space, which creates a doorway. Mike says, well, what if it already exists? And he says, well, it would disrupt magnetic fields, possibly gravity. It could swallow us all up whole. And now the kids have this information, which is exactly what they needed. So, yeah, we do see the folding paper explanation from Event Horizon. I think they do it in Interstellar as well.
Yeah. And also, you know, one minor point here that I hadn't really thought about until this scene, it's interesting. It's almost weird when you see the very first episode that it's like, this is the Hawkins Department of Energy, and you see all this happening. Yes. You're like, I thought that, well, weren't they just like charging people for their power bill? Like, there's secret labs under here. But then when you hear talk about they would need a massive amount of energy to make this happen, it's like, oh, okay. So that's why Brenner has set up shop here, that they have some way to produce an insane amount of energy to open these holes.
Absolutely. 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So back at Hopper's place, we're going to talk a little bit about that. Jessica, why don't you open that door since the AC is off and make this a little cooler?
It's like really hot.
Ooh, some more hot live only action on the podcast.
All right, so let's talk about Hopper's place. Anyway, we're just going to sit her ass down and she slides weights around the floor. You going to sit down so we don't have a big gap here? Let's get cracking. Fucking boo-hoo.
Got to mix up another mimosa, Jessica.
She didn't hear you. All right.
I'm back.
Back at Hopper's place, Callahan and Powell go and visit him. He asks, what are you doing here? He's paranoid immediately. Yeah. They bring up Bev Mooney, something about Henry and Dale going out hunting and not returning. And he equates this to the same location as Mirkwood. So now we could be seeing other people disappearing as this upside down creature starts to cut a swath of destruction through hunter and child and awkward lesbian alike.
And we saw on the little map that Jonathan made with the three X's, it's like it's made its own upside down Bermuda Triangle here. It's like this is the location.
Exactly.
Everything here goes to shit.
Yes.
Upside down triangle.
Hopper says that he will take care of it. They also mentioned the state troopers that had found Barb's car, and he's like,
yeah, of course they fucking did.
Right.
Which is exactly. Because we saw Nancy walk by her car parked right where it was on that street, right by Steve's house. And so they must have gone and like physically fucking towed it over to a fucking bus station to make it look like that. So
they're
fucked.
Bad people.
They also mentioned that, when Powell and Callahan are leaving, did you catch when they say, I wonder if he's off his meds again?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, he's been taking, and he's, we see him take meds all the time.
Choice. We do, yes. We've definitely seen him take the meds before.
Right.
I think that's interesting.
Mm.
And then the other guy says he's spending too much time with Joyce Byers.
There's going to be more. There'll be more to this.
Oh, yeah.
Scott Cummings in the chat, like, wants to go on a date with Barb. I don't know what's going on right now.
Yeah, it's become a little bit of a Barb celebration. So
before he said he was going to go on a date with her, and now he says that her car is parked in front of his house.
Scott Cummings.
I don't know what's happening.
Scott can spot a freak from a mile away.
Nice.
All right. Lonnie takes down the lights and starts fixing shit. By the way, awful. He's just going to slap a couple of, 2x8s or 2x16s or whatever the fuck they are over that hole in the wall.
What, you want to be cold all winter? I'm a fucking provider. Here, let me put some shabby, windy wood against this hole.
A fucking moron. Fucking
great, Lonnie.
And then he brings up the warning signs in the fences, and this is our first indication where he says they ought to be held accountable, where we get a little bit of a tease as to why he's actually there. Not much going on in this scene. We move over to Mike explaining it all to Elle, right? Lucas asks her how she knows about the upside down if she doesn't know about the gateway, right? Dustin's like, let me see everybody's compasses right now. We see him pacing and getting frantic. They're all facing north, right? But that's not true north. This is... We get the sun rising in the east, setting in the west, but they're not pointing to true north. Mike wonders, maybe the compass is broken. He's like, dude, it's a compass. It does not break. There are no batteries.
Do you see any batteries in this? No.
But he does say you can disrupt them with a magnetic field. They, of course, remember what Clark said about the gateway maybe disrupting magnetic fields. And they conclude that they must travel north to find the gateway. Yes. Awesome. More young kid adventure happening. This is great.
Yeah.
And Elle is scared. Like the way the camera lingers on her terrified face, she knows about the upside down. And she knows it is bad shit.
And I love, and it's going to come up later in the episode, the way that Lucas especially gets so frustrated with her, you know, muteness basically. She doesn't talk. She doesn't explain things. One thing I think is interesting is that she understands these things. Like, they're always so annoyed. Like, well, why can't you just tell us where the gate is? How do we go to the upside down? Like, where is it? And I think it's like she has no logical understanding of these things at all. She doesn't even understand these terms. Like, she couldn't put into words these things even if she talked more often. It's like she just has like an intuition, like a sixth sense. Like, she can sense these things. She can sense Mike is close, but she couldn't be like, oh, well, yeah, he's close because if you calculate these vectors and this is how we access the gate and it altered, you know, she has no idea. Like, it's just a feeling for her. And so them like interrogating her gets them nowhere.
Right.
We move back to Joyce and Lonnie. This is another clue. She sees essentially what are get rich attorney flyers and his belongings.
Real, real sneaky, Lonnie.
Yeah. Fucking the heavy hitter.
Douche.
That's what we have up in Massachusetts, the heavy hitter. Call 1-800-LAW-1222.
That is his song.
He's a fucking jacked lawyer guy. He's so annoying to watch.
He calls himself the heavy hitter.
You deserve money. Did you slip and fall and you want to sue the person because you slipped and fell on their property for everything they want? Call me. I am fucking a moral and ethical man.
Anyway. Used to sell used Toyotas and do bail bonds, but now I'm a fucking lawyer.
I love it.
Anyway, Nancy swings a bat. She's practicing. I like this. It's cute.
It's her monster weapon.
It's her monster weapon. She almost kills Steve. And I'm going to dare Jessica to tell me Steve's a bad guy.
God, I like Steve in this scene. It's so hard.
It's so hard
because I want to hate Steve more than I've ever wanted to hate anyone in my life. But then he's cute. Like, he's sweet. And then he sings. And I'm like, oh, he's cute.
He's
not a bad guy. He's not that bad. I'll hate him next
time.
You
are the most inconsistent human I've ever laid eyes on.
I want to hate him so bad.
Why? Why do you want that in your life?
Because I love Jonathan. Listen, and I cannot
lay down
love
on the
one
couch
and hate the other.
Tell me why you need to hate something. Tell me why. Huh?
That's how I live.
Did people not hug and love you enough? All right, let's move on. So, obviously, Steve is awesome here, right?
Yeah.
He's doing the right thing.
He's trying to help her get her mind off the stuff, but when she presses and is like, no, I need to do this, he's like, okay. Like, it's nice that he relents and lets her do what she wants.
He's not fresh about it.
Right. Well, but both of those things are true. But he also does something that shows a bit of maturity and self-awareness. He says, Steve admits to being a dick and apologizes, but then he immediately asks her, he asks her about Barbara, which is something he didn't do before.
Yes, exactly.
And this is something Jessica complained about. She said he needs to try to care on some level. And that's what he does. He learned. Yeah. He's growing up a little here right before our eyes. And he asks about Barbara. He's trying. And then he asks Nancy about the movie to try to forget about things, as you guys mentioned. Let's pretend things are normal just for a little while, which I like. You want to see all the right moves, of course, with Tom Cruise. And Nancy says, thanks, but no thanks.
Yep, yeah.
Yeah.
And then
she's got shit to do, like join the softball team.
Yeah,
just
well,
saying.
See, that means Barbara's right about Nancy.
I know. Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
All right. Johnny and Lois blow up.
Johnny and Lois? What?
Jesus Christ.
Johnny and Lois.
Are they Lois or are they Johnny?
It's CBS's new cop fucking sitcom set in the 1930s New York. Johnny and Lois.
This is the fucking upside down version.
No, this is like a couple name. You just gave them two couple names. They can either be Lois or they can be Johnny.
Neither, because I don't. What do you say? Ship?
Yeah, ship. I don't ship them either.
Stupid terms.
You know what?
You ship Nancy and Jonathan.
I ship Will and the upside down monster.
Wow. What would you call them?
Ooh. You will.
You know what I'd call them? Shit radio. Let's get back to this.
Being so mean.
I'm full of piss and vinegar, as they said in the 50s or something. I don't know.
Piss and vinegar.
All right. So mid-argument, essentially she's calling him out for his bullshit. Lonnie says, we can use that money for good. What are you, fucking Batman? Use it for good? What are you talking about?
We can feed the orphans or some shit.
He tries to say it's for Jonathan's education.
Oh, what bullshit.
Oh, yeah. I love how I'm so fucking proud of her in this scene. She just straight says, fuck you, you're a liar. That's bullshit. Get out.
This is so brutal. I hate when people appeal to the ethical high ground in an attempt to justify their position, even though it's bullshit. They're the worst humans.
Yeah. To justify their own, like, selfishness.
Yes, precisely. And that's exactly what he's trying to do here. But it doesn't work. She calls him on his bullshit. NYU! She kicks him the fuck out. He blames her because, of course, this is a realistic argument. She's got nothing left, so he goes right to the old ad hominem and starts attacking her character. She says, maybe.
Awful.
Which I love. Gosh. She's like, yeah, maybe, but the lights will stay up until I'm dead out of here.
And it's so insanely, this is one of those lines that just sit me over the roof. It's so insanely unfair. Like, he's been gone for obviously years and years. It's safe to say 5-6 years at least. He has not lived here, been with her. And she's taking care of these two kids and had the house and made it work. And he comes back at the one time that it's like the worst situation ever. And she's a little frazzled and the house is, you know, looks wacky. She's hung up lights. And then he's like, see, you suck as a mom. Look how it looks right now. It's like, oh, really?
No one disappeared when I was here.
Right. Like, oh, 7 years ago when I was drunk. Like, yeah, you pick out the one worst low moment in this person's life and try to say that oh, this proves you're a shitty person all the time. Fuck you.
Mm-hmm. He's actually the worst human being of all time, honestly.
This scene definitely seals it.
I like how they take the energy of the scene and they put it right into the crack of the pistol shot. That was a nice transition.
True.
Jonathan's so not a good shot with a .38. He's nope. firing a .38 stub nose from a decent distance away.
But he doesn't even hit a stump. I mean,
doesn't hit a stump.
God damn. I feel like you should be hitting something on accident by then.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, no kidding.
Like or maybe Jonathan. A jogger.
You know, the road is right behind the stumps because he's that much of an idiot.
Somebody's
just
dead.
He just fucking blows away a jogger, throws her into the upside down tree.
And this is how Mystic River started. Nice. But I love when Nancy comes up on the scene and he asks her, "You ever shot a gun before?" I'm like, dude, you need to be asking yourself that. Like, don't yes, start sir. Getting all fucking sexist over here. You're not shooting so well.
Yeah.
I like the scene between the two of them, though. I think that's cute. I like that she comes over and the first thing she does is, like, tease him.
Oh, my God.
And they have a very good, like, rapport back and forth with each other.
Jessica, it's you want to tell sweet. Dean to shut up and let's talk about how much we ship him for a while?
Okay, yes. Because I do.
Oh, my God.
Literally love them.
It's cute.
Can't even tell you.
It's definitely a good scene for sure. Nancy's like, I met your dad. They talk about Thumper, the rabbit he killed when he was 10, cried for a week. Jonathan doesn't remember a time when mom and dad loved each other.
But he knows they must have.
But he knows they must have. And Nancy says she doesn't think her parents ever did. And I like this parallel here. Again, we see Nancy discussing the American dream. He was older, had a good job, they got married, blah, blah, blah. It's a bunch of bullshit, essentially, is what she's saying.
And she's discussing this with Jonathan, not Steve, her boyfriend, but with Jonathan.
With Jonathan. And then she sends a couple of 38 rounds downrange and blows up some cans. She's a natural.
Nice.
Of course. We all knew that was going to happen, right?
Fucking Annie Oakley over here.
Yeah, nice. So we move over to Hopper calling
his ex-wife, yep. I assume.
I think her name is Janet.
I think, yeah. It's brutal. This is a brutal scene. This feels like a final goodbye for him.
Oh,
like,
yes, it does.
This is him, like, really signing off. If there's one person in the world he wants to call and just make a last amend with, it's his ex-wife.
Right.
Oh, so sad.
I know.
He doesn't regret the 7 years. Take care of yourself. Say hi to Bill.
No, what's interesting is he doesn't regret the 7 years. They meant anything to him. She's like, have you been drinking? And he says, no. Then he hears the baby crying. He remembers she has a new life, a new child. Right. She's moved on. He hasn't. And he says, actually, I have been drinking. Say hi to Bill, the new husband, father of the baby, mm-hmm. for me. I just think it's interesting how he wants to have this honest conversation with her. She assumes he's been drinking, and he continues to want to be honest until he remembers that she's moved on with her life, and he doesn't want to drag her down with him,
yeah,
I guess.
For sure. And so
it's very sad.
Yeah, and so he even, like, I don't think he has been drinking. He just says that to, like, buy into her expectations of him. He's just like, yeah,
right.
You know what? Yeah, you're right. I've been drinking. Sorry I bothered you.
It's so sad.
It's brutal. Yeah, it hurts.
What do you think Bill looks like, Matt?
Oh, he is a carbon copy of Mr. Wheeler.
I thought so, too.
She bought another model. She went down to the husband store and bought a Mr. Wheeler.
Can I have one Mr. Wheeler, please?
What did I do?
I think Bill has, I think he wears pleated shorts. I think he has.
he goes to the tailor and gets him to put pleats in his shorts?
Yep, he has pleated shorts. I think he definitely has brown boat shoes. He wears a pink polo, and he has a sweater tied up around his shoulders. A very non-threatening haircut. He's very clean cut. But he does have a sports car because he has the money for that, and he thinks somehow that makes him edgy. But really, it's just people fucking him for his money, which is fine, but let's be real about who you are.
And he's not having an affair, but when he rolls by high schools, he lingers a little too long. It's a little uncomfortable. Yeah.
He may take that manual transmission Porsche 911 into neutral and rev it up as he's going by the buses and all the girls want to just get in his bus, but they don't, and they should, because they might end up getting on Mr. Wheeler's bus by accident.
No, good.
I definitely think that's what he looks like for sure. Yeah,
for sure.
He's definitely thin. He's thin, and he has really dumb stories about his college years that nobody cares about. He's got that Porsche, and he's got that sweater.
The American dream.
And he has that very non-threatening haircut, and he has proper sex with Janet now that Hopper's out of the picture.
Wow.
That's my character. You guys like it?
Way to bring a sad, touching scene into this.
That's my point. I didn't want to linger
and
on that.
We close with Missionary with the lights off. Night, dear.
No, but I think I'm just trying to do what the show has been doing. Every time there's a downer, they kick it back up with the kids. So I'm just playing my part here. Yeah, I'm just doing my part. Andrew in the chat says he's balding. Yeah, he is balding, and he has kind of a comb over for sure. Yeah, but he's going to get those hair implants that will look awful. Definitely dyes his hair.
Sure. Good Lord.
Which is the worst when you're a man. Stop it. Men, stop that. You're fucking foolish.
Right.
Your children. Stop dyeing your hair, man.
And so that is the story of Hopper's ex-wife's new husband.
Yeah.
In case you guys are wondering.
Our fanfic it for you.
Back on the train tracks. I hate to do it.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Stand by me. It's an exact shot, not to fucking beat a dead horse.
Because Dean watched it last night before he went to bed. There is a scene
where they're walking two up front, two in the back, and it is an exact shot from Stanley.
And Dean's holding up his printed screenshot of that scene to the computer now.
Listen,
this is correct.
I'm not the one with Stand By Me's dick in its mouth. That's the fucking Duffer Brothers, whatever these guys call themselves. That's these guys. I'm simply reporting the news. I'm just the fucking journal trying to get to the bottom of this. The journal or the journalist? Is that what I'm trying to say? Journalist.
There you go.
Good. Yeah. Lord.
What are you going to do? I don't know.
But Dustin here is saying, do you think she's acting weird? No, it's Lucas who says it. You think she's acting weird. And Dustin's like, you mean the weirdo acting weird? Yeah.
Right.
Also, it breaks my heart a little bit every time they call her weirdo. I love her so much. I'm always like, you stop that. Don't be mean to her. Don't you call her weirdo.
You're adorable. So we get a flashback. Elle is going to bath, I guess. Papa asks if that's okay. She says yes, but
we have got to talk about here. Why does Brenner even bother with asking her, is that okay? Like, why fuck with... She's her prisoner. He can do whatever he wants with her, obviously. I mean, he throws her into fucking closets. I mean, you know, he has total power over her, but there is still some kind of actual rapport between the two of them that he's built up because, in my mind, either he is her real father and he's fucking twisted as hell, or he took her away from whoever her real parents are at such a young age and has brainwashed her enough to where she has what she thinks is affection for him and she doesn't really know how to feel for him. But she is pretty willfully doing these things at his request.
They definitely have a relationship beyond what is a prisoner and a captor.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's clear.
Yeah, for sure.
And, well, you know what, Matthew, you better just get behind the experiment because it's for the greater good, right?
Yeah.
Right? We're going to rally the greater good banner. We're going to use her to defeat our enemies and spy on Russia. Come on. We can torture a kid for that, right?
That's worth
it. Think all the lives we're going to save by just torturing one little girl.
Boy, this guy, Lord. I'm not voting for this guy for president.
You fucking cool.
Come on. You fucking, if I can pull the fucking toenails off one 9-year-old with a pair of pliers and we save the country, isn't it worth it? Come on.
Come on.
Come on.
All right. Nancy and Jonathan are in the woods. Jessica, take me through this.
So, again, I love these two and ship them, obviously, as a couple.
In case anyone forgot from 2 minutes ago.
I like the conversation they have where she brings up the stalker photos, obviously. She's got to, you know, check out what was really going on there. And he says that she was a girl trying to be someone else.
Beautiful.
But then she was alone and she could be herself. And she gets pissed off and immediately starts sticking up for Steve when Jonathan isn't even really talking about Steve. It's like she automatically goes into this like defense mode because I think she realizes that Steve is not who she is as a person or sees her as who she really is.
Yes.
As she's having this conversation with Jonathan, like this kind of open conversation. So she immediately calls BS and starts going into this defense of him.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonathan's like, whatever. Like, why are you defending him to me?
I think she's also trying to get the attention off of herself because I think she knows somehow he's right.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Although, to play devil's advocate for a little bit here, a lot of ball busting just for her, you know, meeting a guy she likes and getting laid. What the hell's the problem? I mean,
right.
Damn.
Right. I think that's definitely a fair point.
I love their, as their conversation continues, when she was like, oh, I was starting to like you. I thought you weren't a pretentious creep. And he's like, oh, I liked you too. I thought that you weren't a boring suburban girl pretending to be a rebel who's just going to end up like her parents, essentially, which really cuts to the core.
Oh, yeah. Fucking.
These two know each other, and it's so funny because they have not interacted a ton as far as we know, other than their brothers having been friends before this point. But their relationship to one another, the way they call each other out, the way they see each other, it's very like intimate.
Doesn't that just,
you know what I mean?
Doesn't that just speak to like high school and how you had opinions of people, like fully fleshed out opinions of people that you barely interacted with at all? Like, I can't think of any other time of life where it's more like that. Like in high school, yeah, this kid that is in my class and I've talked to them maybe once ever, but they have a reputation in the school and you have a fully formed opinion of how that person is. And when you stop so thinking about it, you're like, I don't fucking know them at all. Like, how can I actually judge this? But they
just
totally
give me your fucking lunch money, will you? I think you make a good point here, though, and I think it's just that when you're younger, it's easier to ignore nuance and to categorize. That's why things are so clicky, right? And I think that's what we're seeing here. He's essentially making a sweeping generalization about her based on very few interactions with her, and that's it. That's what he does. That's what the young mind can do.
But I think that they both, in this conversation, like, Nancy hears what she says, and I think she's like, is that me? And the same on his end. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
They value each other's opinions.
They
I'm
do.
I'm punched you in the face right now.
Why is that?
Because you just made that face at me.
What face?
Where you smiled. I make sure you're making fun of me because I said something that I say all the time.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's.
This is one of those times where I wish I could see you guys.
Video podcast, sooner or later. All right, Hopper goes to see Joyce. Don't say anything. He holds
like
up
Lost,
the signs.
It's that one beautiful. Episode, you know.
He starts to look around, and we move back to the kids, realizing they're heading back home.
Oh, wait, but when he starts to look around, this is very important. He looks around, and he sees the lights everywhere, and he says, Jesus Christ.
Right.
Because he realizes he's going to have to go through every single one of those lights.
That's a great
looking
point.
For
he's going to have to do a Clark Griswold fucking redo every single light.
I love it.
Did you say Clark Griswold? Who's that? Help me out.
Are you serious
right now?
Yeah.
Holy
Get
shit.
Get out of here.
Finally, me and Jessica have something over you.
I'm sorry. Vacation?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus
Christmas
Christ.
Vacation?
Of course.
The lights?
Yep. You're fired.
You're
all right.
Dead to me.
Dean, it was a good run you had. Me and Jessica can take it from here.
See you later.
I'll be over here swallowing a shotgun fucking load. You guys, good luck with the show. I am,
Mark Griswold.
You know what, Shackle? Oh, fuck yourself. You guys all pipe down. Fucking mess. Every one of you can suck it. All right.
The reaction from me and Matthew.
Have your moment.
Was so genuine.
Have your moment. You fuck.
Oh, King Kong ain't got nothing.
And then I get killed by Russian monsters.
Slit up.
Shit. I definitely feel like Denzel at the end of Training Day right now. I am not liking it.
fuck.
Yeah. All right. You guys done? You had your moment?
Done.
I guess, but
how's your
I'll
virtual
never forget
high
it.
Five?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I was like, we got to get our virtual high five in. Good job, high Jessica.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's good.
I will burn Rome to the fucking ground.
All right. Play my fiddle and watch it burn.
Yes. All right.
Dance for me, Caligula. All right. The kids realize they're heading back home. Dustin notices it, and Lucas flips the fucking lid.
Because Lucas is the voice of like the people who are not crazy, and he's like, what the fuck? We're following compasses while a little girl who bleeds from the nose and makes magical things happen, and our friend is in an upside-down world.
Our How magic is girl life? Is breaking our compasses. This is our life now.
I love Lucas because he's such a little kid. Like, he draws odd lines in certain places. He's like, I can believe everything else, but not this. And it really comes back to not trusting her.
Yeah.
He doesn't and at all.
He's right. It sucks that he's mad about it. He's frustrated. And you know what's funny? Like, he loves Will. He loves Will as much as Mike and Dustin do.
Oh, yeah.
And he's just expressing himself in a more frustrated way because he doesn't trust this girl.
Yeah.
And, you know, I appreciate that. I appreciate the fact that he has a different perspective. It's not like he's not like everybody else. And that's awesome.
Yeah.
And he has a right to be mad. Or he has a right to be like, why are you misleading us? Just fucking be honest. Why are you wasting our time? And it comes down to Will is in there and who knows what's happening. And this is a waste of time.
Yeah. And these scenes where they confront Elle about this stuff are it's so painful for me. I feel so bad for her because like I was saying earlier, it's like I think she literally cannot articulate these things. Like, she wouldn't even know how. She did, like I was saying, it's just like some intuitive sense she has, even if she could speak. And who knows exactly why. Maybe it's just a fear thing, or maybe she actually just is, I don't know, so hesitant to actually speak, or doesn't have a lot of vocabulary. Maybe Papa Brenner didn't teach a lot, didn't do a lot of flashcards while he was making her a slave. I don't know. But the thing is, like, I think she is unable to even logically put in order what you know, describe what is actually going on. She, like, couldn't tell them if she wanted to.
I concur. But it doesn't mean Lucas isn't going to feel pissed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They feel like they've wasted all their time.
He says, I noticed her wiping her nose, the bloody sleeve. You've been fucking with the compasses. Well, he doesn't say that. Jesus.
Yeah, he doesn't use those words. Stop that.
You've been fucking with the compasses, bitch. Holy shit, Lucas.
Who taught you those words?
He says, HBO. He says he knew it. Mike asks, that's old blood, right? She says it's not. And boy, poor
she
Mike.
Says
I love
it's
watching.
Not safe.
I love watching Mike's face when he realizes that Lucas is right, because he puts so much faith in Elle.
Yeah.
It's so heartbreaking.
Oh, it is. And he's kid. And this is something, you know, I know you guys have talked about it, but this is my moment. I haven't got to be on the show yet. But I love these kids. And I think you made a good point earlier, Dean, when you're talking about, like, what is it? Because this is a hard, when you think about it, this is a hard sell, and it's a hard recipe to make work. You know, a very easy thing to tank your movie or your TV show is a bad kid actor. Like, yep. I always think of the season of Married with Children when they added that little fucking blonde kid, and he's just fucking insufferable. And it was,
I wanted to shoot napalm in his face.
It was so terrible. Bad. You know, it was just like some producer's kid, or like, make my baby a star. Like, it's terrible. And it's very, you know, it's a tough thing to make, to have a child actor who's both good and to make their story actually charming and not feel like contrived by an adult. Like, it's hard sometimes to make the writing of a show like this. Like, this is an adult writing what a kid would do. It doesn't naturally feel like what kids might do. And I feel like a big part of that was what you pointed out earlier, Dean, of like the situation they're facing is actually overwhelming. And as adults, we can see it and go, you kids can't handle this. Like, this is beyond you. But we see that they have, you know, the moxie and the naive confidence to charge at it anyways. And that's what we find so endearing. And I feel like this show has nailed that. Like, it has that feel of, like, the Goonies and the old shows. And all of the kids, all of them, especially Elle, are just incredible actors. Like, I'm amazed at the range they're able to have as kids this young. I mean, I think the actress who plays Elle just turned like 12. They're so young.
Oh my God. She's just so kids. Good. Yeah. They're all so good.
So good.
There you go. Yeah, you're right about a little kid can destroy stuff. And you know what? This is going to sound mean, but like, Jake Lloyd can suck it.
That sounds mean. It sounds kind to me,
I don't
honestly.
Know. I mean, I know I'm telling a little kid some horrible
shit. Speaking of children
shit,
that ruin things.
But, you know, I'm sorry. Sorry,
there's
kid.
A ruiner for sure.
Well, anyway.
He's my age, arrested back in South Carolina now, so don't feel too bad.
No, that's why I said it.
You definitely suck at that.
All right. Hopper and Joyce, they finish searching her place for bugs. He tells her that they bugged my place, a microphone. I'm onto it, and they know it. I'm onto them, he says. Hopper tells her about the morgue. It wasn't him. It was a fake. I mean, this is a big revelation for
you.
Joyce.
Were right the whole time.
This,
you were right.
This is it. This is the scene I was talking about. This is maybe the most important scene of the series so far. And that, you know, this conspiracy is not hidden among, you know, the people committing it now. People know. The chief of police
knows.
It's not Joyce knows.
They're not little nucleuses of, right?
Yeah. And it makes me so happy. There are so many times in shows or movies where there's a character like Joyce who is like, suffering, you know, knowing the truth of something or feeling like they know the truth of something. Everybody else is like, you're fucking crazy. And then finally, maybe when people do come around and realize it, they just kind of hop on board and start helping them. Nobody takes the time to say, you were right. You were right the whole time. You had it. You're not crazy. And you can see her. She smiles right after he said it. Like, she is elated by that. And it's so good. I'm so glad he took the time to just flat out, like, validate. Like, yes, you are not fucking crazy. You are right. It's like, good. She deserves that. Damn it.
We hard cut to the kids arguing.
Oh, I have more to say about this.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Whoa.
Whoa, pump the brakes there, cowboy. Hold your horses there, pal.
Is it about how you shipped Hopper and Joyce? Hell yeah, let's do it.
Yes.
Oh, my God, Matthew. Let's fucking get in there. Encourage her. Jesus Christ.
I do ship them. But I just want to talk in general about the way this show...
About...
Stop.
Who's your favorite Canadian hockey team?
I'm gonna murder you.
Where's David Earl? Is he in the chat? No.
No.
Damn it.
He's making fun of me already.
He will when he listens.
I love the way the show has handled the relationship between Joyce and Hopper, which there is clearly like a significant relationship between the two of them that they have not been obvious about. But the way these two interact with each other, it's so clear that there's this trust between them and that there is this pre-existing relationship. And here in the scene, we see, who does Hopper go to tell? Yes, it's Joyce's dead son. But you would think, you know, if he's going to open up with somebody, maybe that's not the first person he wants to talk to. The woman everybody thinks is crazy.
Right.
But he goes right to Joyce to tell her. And I think there's a lot to be said from the fact that he walks into her house, he looks at all the lights, and Joyce sits there and she lets him take down every single light.
Right.
When she just a couple of scenes ago said, I will leave these lights up until I die, basically.
Great point.
Because immediately he comes in there and he's like, we need to take these lights down, and she trusts him.
That's really great.
And that's so important.
Great
and it means so much about the show and the relationship between the two of them that's been established in such a beautiful way. That's great writing.
You've redeemed yourself.
Yeah.
On this
fucking
podcast
swish
episode.
From Jessica. 3 points.
And I
give her, let's
them
clap the
still.
Hands.
Yay.
Nice work.
Now, anyways, back to shipping Joyce and Hopper. So I think. No,
oh, my God. Negative 1,000 points. The kids are fighting, and Luke's pissed. He's yelling, why didn't she just tell us? She made us run around. She helped just enough. She's like a stray dog. She did what she needed to get what she needed. Wake the hell up, man. She's letting them... this is a very strong sentence here. She's letting him die in the upside-down world.
Did you ever stop to think that maybe she's the monster?
Mm. The boys fight. Elle breaks that shit up hard, sends Lucas flying.
Because this is Elle's instinct immediately is to protect Mike.
Right.
She's not trying to be an asshole. She's not trying to hurt Lucas. It's just she sees that Mike is in trouble, and immediately she's like, I have to protect him.
Right.
It's very sweet.
Right.
I ship them, too. Just kidding, but not really.
I do like this moment, though, because this shows how they've built a dynamic relationship between these characters, because we see Mike's loyalty to Lucas.
Yeah.
He's mad at Elle for this.
Mm-hmm.
He immediately turns on her because Lucas is his friend forever, right?
Yeah.
And that's great. What is this? We see when it gets ugly, he zones in and protects his buddy.
Absolutely.
We get Elle's flashback. She seems to be spying on Russians, some sort of astral walk here. This looks like under the skin background.
I was just going to say, yes.
Right?
So under the skin.
It seems that she's walking on this water. We listen to this man speak in Russian. We hear his voice on the speakers in the lab. So she's like this conduit.
Yeah.
She just inspects him. And then we hear the beast. The Russian man vanishes in this puff of smoke, pulling some Dracula shit here. And then the creature chases her. She runs fast. She's in the water. She's screaming. And she's in the tank.
So what do we think about this? What do you guys think? Because this, to me, seems like the way Brenner and the other scientists react to hearing the sound of the creature on there, this is first contact. Like, this is the, you know, this whole, her being there and her telepathy is all, you know, this is the height of the Cold War. They're going to use her to mind spy on the Russians and get in there, I guess, through some weird astral projection. But in doing this, it has brushed up against the other dimension or in some way. And do you, I'm kind of asking you, I guess, for predictions in a way. Like, what do you think we're going to see as far as how it got to the point where a gate actually opened up in the lab? Do you think they shift gears and they actually try to access these monsters and open this up and it just blows up in their face? Like, what?
This is a really good question. I thought a lot about this. I think what we're seeing is much like they discussed earlier in the episode, Mr. Clark is talking about this parallel universe. I think we've established that. I think in this parallel universe that the laws of physics do not really apply as normal. And I think as a result, we can travel distances. I think the rules of time and space are a bit different. And I think it's not really astral projection so much it is as a dimensional walk, a shadow walk, as the kids mentioned. And I think she just finds this guy by way of this dimensional travel and can spy on him. And because of these powers that she has, she is this conduit to get that information back into the other universe.
Makes me think, because, when she's that under the skin looking place, the black area with the water on the ground, that's not the upside down world. It's sort of like maybe an in-between place of dimensions. It's like, the lines of the borders themselves between dimensions. And she's kind of able to poke her head back into our dimension in Russia somewhere to see this guy. And then I guess that's in this border area, those creatures have the power to kind of cross over too.
Yeah.
I think maybe we're seeing the tightrope. right?
Exactly. Yeah.
I think the black is the tightrope, and it's allowing her to move interdimensionally, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And
the creature is the flea.
Maybe. It could be the flea, and I definitely think that they discover this place, and now, you like you said, it's first contact with whatever lurks in these areas, whatever monsters lurk here are part of the issue, and I think that's what we're seeing. But I like it. I think it's a cool thing, and I think that's what's going on here. Now, what I'm really curious about is L a anomaly? Is this something that's been going on for a while, and it's just unrelated? Is it just totally unrelated? In other words, is the parallel universe separate than the mind power, but the mind power people can be used to access it in a unique way?
I think that's...
In other words, yeah. I do too. I think the mediums, I think the telepathy, I think the L-like characters that exist in this universe exist there as an independent thing to these parallel universes, but they can be used to move among them and perceive greater than the average bear in there by way of communicating, etc. I think that's what we're seeing here.
Yeah. And I can imagine maybe, you know, Andrew Gaskin even pointed out in the chat that her being in that water tank with the thing on her head, it's like almost like the bath, the Cerebro in X-Men.
Right.
And that's kind of it. I mean, I think I could imagine that maybe, you know, in the earlier part of this scene when we see her talking to Brenner, he's saying, we're going to go farther than we ever have before. And he shows her the picture of the guy she's going to spy on. So it's like this is probably the first time they'd ever tried to boost her powers this much so that she could hear somebody that far away.
Testing the distance.
Yeah. Yep. And I could imagine that maybe they try to boost it even further now that they've heard some other thing in that, you know, dimensional area. And then that boosting it, that amount of energy while she's attached to it also cracks it open and like allows it to come in.
I think we're seeing a connection with water too. We have the pool, we have the water tank. I think water is some sort of physical barrier that is some sort of factor in these dimensional shifts.
Good point. Yeah.
And it's true, we see the it pool, come, yeah.
And there's that episode, I think it's the first or second, where we see Brenner actually go to the Joyce's house and goes into the shed where Will disappears. And he has that little radio, you know, radioactive like meter. And it goes off when he goes into that corner. And there's just a little speck of that goo on the corner like that. It's the liquidy fluid itself that like maybe, you know, because we see the big gate inside the lab is just covered in goop. It's just like this gigantic goopy hole. And so it seems like maybe the accretion of that stuff is what allows gates to open. I don't know.
I like it.
Whew, lots of theories going, flying.
We're all going to be completely wrong with
everything. Oh, fuck yeah.
We're all going to be so wrong.
So at the end, the final scene here, Nancy and Jonathan at night in the woods. They continue their patrol. Nancy thinks she hears something, and she does. She finds a wounded doe.
Sad face.
Yeah, Nancy thinks it was hit by a car, but I don't know about that.
Oh, and have we mentioned that L has run away? Like, the last we see of
L. Ran away.
Sorry, yes.
Lucas and L both ran away.
Yeah,
Lucas comes too. They let him run off.
Lucas says, screw you guys, I'm going home. And L disappears. And this is what I was talking about of, like, more an emotional kind of cliffhanger of, like, I don't think anybody's like, oh, maybe L just got killed. Like, no, we just know that she's run off, and we don't know how strained their relationship with, you know, her relationship with the kids is going to be now.
Sure, I like it. They continue their patrol. Nancy stops walking. We come across the doe, as we mentioned. She thinks it was hit by a car, but no. Jonathan takes the gun. I'm not nine anymore. He wants to put this thing out of his misery. First things first, get a little closer, buddy.
Right.
I'm not.
You're a
confident.
Bad shot, and we all know.
Yeah. Get a lot closer, because if you put a bullet in this thing's neck and it suffers more, you're a fucking idiot.
He takes off its ear. Oh, whoops. Oh, blasts off its nose. Oh,
Jesus
shit. Fuck.
Christ.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, Nancy. I'm so sorry.
He just starts putting holes in its body. Dude, are you doing?
Oh, fuck. I got to reload. Oh, I'm sorry.
Then he puts it to its head and it just goes click. He's like, oh, sorry.
Nancy, you're going to have to stomp on its head. I'm sorry.
it just turns into the most slapstick, awful shit ever.
Jesus.
Anyway, so yeah, they're going to do the right thing here, but boom, it gets dragged away by an unseen force. Whoa. They start to look for the doe. They get separated, I guess, which is silly.
Yeah, this was a little weird. I'm like, what? How did you guys get separated? Like, you just dodge off in different directions in the dark of the woods? What the hell was that about?
Meet you later. Bye.
Nancy.
We'll rendezvous somewhere. Anyways, bye.
Nancy compels. Nancy, compelled to find her friend, crawls into the fucking new dimension through the tree, which is some sort of conduit, obviously. She crawls in and emerges on the other side, and the tree just goes and closes down.
Oof, fuck.
What?
That's crazy.
Nancy has got balls of solid rock.
Balls.
That is the episode, guys.
Well,
that's it.
Well, we see her see the monster. We got to say that.
Yeah,
oh,
eating
of course.
The deer.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't finish my notes.
Munching on Bambi. Her light is
and
going
Jonathan
out. We see the floating specks.
Floating specks, as you mentioned. Yep. And that's it. We'll talk about the final scene and what we think's going forward. But Matthew, do you have a couple of listener comments for us?
I do believe I've got them.
All right. Get those cracking, brother.
All right. You know what? I'm going to start with Mr. Floyd Fry. And he said,
floating.
At first, I was like, what the hell is Hopper thinking and exactly what is his plan with sneaking into this lab? But I had to remind myself that this is the first thing he has probably cared about since his daughter's death. He probably thinks that saving Will could give him peace from the loss of his daughter. So in that context, I guess I understand him doing whatever it takes. I also kind of wondered about the buyer's shed before, so now I ponder. Will is chased there, the lights stop working, and he disappears. Hopper investigates and goes into some kind of trance where he can't hear his name being called. The lab weirdos, is what I was mentioning about the goo in there, the lab weirdos investigate and say what they found was extraordinary. When Nancy goes through the tree gate, dimensional portal, whatever you want to call it, her flashlight stops working. She sees that the monster has pulled the deer through to that world. Or do we assume there is or was one of these gates in that shed?
Mm-hmm. I think there are multiple gates dotted around. And I think that much like the Shadow Veil, this life, this world exists very close to us and we just can't see it. And part of me wonders if the fact that they can see these gates now is because they're starting to see more of the truth. I wonder if there is some sort of thing happening where the more you learn about this other dimension, the more you can perceive the openings into that other dimension versus the people who are weighed down by the crushing weight of the banal world just can't. They just can't see them like these people can. That's part of what it may, maybe it could be, but I do think that there are multiple entry points dotted throughout the world if we're to believe that there is a world directly next to ours.
Yeah.
That's my take on it. But I do like his point on Hopper. I think that's very, very consistent with Hopper. I think he's a man who, I think what they've been trying to show us is that he has a lot of empty relationships. He has a lot of guilt. He is a man who has lost his daughter and has just sort of been drifting through life. This man who is a sheriff of a small town where nothing exciting ever happens. And whatever he was meant for has passed him by. And now he's just living out his days in boredom. And I think that he is starting to get this opportunity and he will put himself at great danger. And I like that we see this parallel between Hopper and the kids, their willingness to just do crazy shit to get to the bottom of this. And I think it just shows that Hopper has been waiting for a long time to get to something bigger than himself, to redeem the loss of his daughter, to make this right by finding Will or at least exposing the truth about Will. No matter what the consequences are. And I think that's a good note by Floyd there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, good stuff, Floyd. Who else you got?
Well, there is one more by Mr. Jamie Lomas. Do either of you guys want to read it or you want me to read it?
Yeah, we don't have him up, so you go.
Oh, yeah, bunch of slacking fucks. All right. Jamie Lomas says, I have a bad feeling about one of the kids dying before the end. And with Lucas saying about Elle, for all we know, it's her fault, and Mr. Clark saying that science is not very forgiving, I'm getting the feeling that Elle is responsible for opening up the giant vagina in the wall and introducing the plant-faced monster to our world. I don't think the consequences will be very forgiving. R.I.P., you adorable little girl. R.I.P.
No!
I know.
That's so dark.
My reply to that comment, I will repeat here, is that if she dies, I'm going to be flipping cars like a fucking British soccer hooligan.
Seriously?
I will be so upset if that happens. Oh, my God.
That's not right. It's just not right.
It's not. You shouldn't have done that to me, Jitta boy. It's not right.
Awesome.
Freaking Jamie Lomas. I might not read his blog after all. I know that's what he's right about.
Making enemies, burning bridges.
Let me go ahead and read one of the comments in the chat right now. Again, mixler.com/lsg-media, where we're recording this live. Andrew Gaskin says, I think my only critique of the show is the monster. I've tried to force myself to like it, but I feel it could have been something creepier. The first peek of of it we get in an episode one was awesome with its almost Slender Man-like long arms. Maybe I'm more upset that we are seeing so much of it so early. And this is something Jessica and I have talked about. I agree
with
you there.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. They could have made it a misty sort of nondescript thing that was just more scary,
yeah.
Less detailed.
You know, on that point, and I could be totally wrong, and this is totally fucking speculating out of my ass, but I, from that first episode, the way it's walking, the way it's moving, it has the whole Slender Man looking thing going for it. I'm actually wondering if there's more than one creature out there. Like that, the thing that took Will is a more humanoid, intelligent thing, whereas the thing we see eating the deer is like a wild animal in that world. You know what I mean?
I like it. I think there's definitely a larger world at play here. Maybe we've only seen one, but I got to believe there's more.
Yeah, so I think that's possible.
Wow.
Good stuff.
That's crazy.
All right, let's wrap this up. Matthew, what do you want to say about this episode or maybe the trajectory of the series thus far?
Boy, oh boy. You know, as much as I hope Jamie Lomas is wrong, and I do, I think I'll go ahead and say that I don't think any of the kids is going to outright die, but I do think there's going to be some severe losses. Maybe a main character, someone will also be lost, and it's gonna be rough. And you know, the episode where they find what they thought was, you know, Will Byers' body and the kids' reactions there was absolutely brutal. And this show, I'm continually impressed by, you know, of course, just how entertaining it is, but how damn near like masterfully they have this balance of levity and fun, and also very legitimately X-Files level scary and dark stuff going on. It's incredibly well balanced. I mean, like, I haven't seen a show like this in so long that can have me laughing and just like cooing about how adorable these kids are, and then the next scene, like, oh my, holy shit, it's ripping that deer apart. It's like, it's so varied, but they have balanced that really well. And this episode is a super good example of that. You know, we have the charming looks at the kids, but then, you know, the scarier elements all about it. But you know me, Dean and Jessica, you know how much I've talked on other podcasts about how much I love the larger underlying conspiracy arc coming to light. Like, that's the shit I love. Right. I love seeing those the underlying threads coming higher and higher to the surface. And this was a great, like I was saying, it has the most important scene of the series so far of Hopper now being aware of it and telling Joyce that he's aware and validating that you were right. This is something fucking crazy is going on. And that is the biggest stake-raising moment of the show so far. Like, now we know that Joyce is going to get more actively involved in, like, trying to take down this lab or find her son. And it's going to – it's from this episode on, I can feel the momentum building toward, like, a really more fast-paced last, you know, episode or two. And I think, yeah, they've built up those stakes fantastically. You know, I have no idea what's going to happen with the kids and Elle. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't get to see Elle interact with the kids again until the last episode. Like, she runs off into the woods, maybe gets picked up by Brenner again, and we don't see them have these beautiful, charming little scenes together like we've had. And that is also a loss in its own way. And that, I'm like, oh, man, that would suck. Like, I love seeing the kids together. And so there's some great, just great building here. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
I can't wait to watch the next episode.
As soon as we're done here, I'm telling you.
I feel like now we're ramping it up. We've established our characters. We've established our mystery, our conspiracy, all of it. And now it's going to be getting to the bottom of it for the rest of the season. Like, there's no more setup that needs to be done. Now we're just getting to it. And I cannot wait.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, I agree. I don't have much to add to that, Matthew, other than I'm looking forward to seeing the characters who know the truths start to interact together, to start to team up a little bit. I think we're going to see a little bit more of that going forward, which is going to be cool. I think that's going to play into the conclusion of this. I definitely think you are on the money with this Will thing. Maybe we will with L. But what I do look forward to maybe Will interacting with these kids again. I miss that little dude.
Aww. I know. I agree.
I love his little scenes. They're so cute. But
super cute, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to be getting back after it again. I think on Tuesday we're going to be recording the next episode. It's Sunday.
I think so.
So this one will be available maybe later today, tomorrow. And we're going to get to chapter 6, I guess, for Tuesday. That's tentative. But I think that's what we're going
to
do.
That'll be a back to Dean and Jessica only show. I say my farewell.
Yeah,
Matthew's still going to watch the rest of the series today.
Yes, he's right already now, warned me. Well, that's cool. I definitely appreciate you jumping on, Matthew. Jessica, I had fun. Jessica, tell these good people good night.
Good night, good people.